Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, we have a fantastic show for you.
On nighttalkradio.com. Looking to email the show? TerrorJam2012@gmail.com. Or come to our blog, nighttalkradio.com. Phone lines are open, 347-324-3287. 347-324-3287. This is Night Talk Radio on the Terror Chat Radio Network with host Colin Knight.
And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, madame and messieurs, boys and girls, mes enfants. Welcome to, what a great night to be alive. It's another wonderful weekend here in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. 23 degrees Celsius currently, 79 degrees Fahrenheit to our Fahrenheit audience. It is Saturday, August the 18th, 2012. We're 146 days to the full galactic alignment. And that would be December the 21st, of course, 2012. And we shall make sure that we are on the air that night. So mark it on your calendar, not just for the end of the world. Tonight we have back with us Thomas Fusco, who was with us earlier this month to discuss in depth the meat and potatoes of Mr. Fusco's work, which basically was encapsulated in his book, Behind the Cosmic Veil. Good evening, Thomas. How are you tonight?
Very good, Colin. Yourself?
If I was any better, sir, I would be suspicious. It's been one of those days, very busy, but a very beautiful day here in Calgary.
Oh, that's great.
So, Thomas, when we last left off, we had kind of put a skeleton on your theories and your understandings of the cosmic realm. Now, when you was, it was, I think it was the 4th of this month, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was two weekends ago.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And I'm just wondering, with your scientific investigation, Thomas, when you began to produce the book, was the cosmic veil unveiling in front of you, or did you already have that parameters before you went into it?
Well, I think very early on I had a certain image in my mind of a couple different elements of this model, this paradigm, this theory. And, you know, as in so many other complex works, the challenge was then to kind of flesh it out, to, do a lot of research to find corroborating evidence, pieces of information that fit in. And if I could find something that really was in direct violation of this concept that I had. And then, of course, there was there's also the challenge of taking this and reducing it into a easily communicable form,
right?
Because there's a lot of folks out there that come up with some very wonderful ideas, and they never seem to get out of the esoteric format of it. And my, you know, I was always a very down-to-earth fella, and so, you know, if you can't communicate it effectively, what good is it? So,
and a lot of work. That's the basically the premise of the show, is we're not looking for the highfalutin. We're looking for the truth and those words that make sense to us common folk, as they say. It doesn't matter what the actual chemical or scientific formula is. If we don't understand its concept, it might as well be Chinese.
Yes, and you know, behind most things in science and physics that seem very complex on the surface, the general concepts, the basic conceptualizations, are not that difficult to grasp. Einstein, now some of his work is very, very deep, and yet he built what he called these mental experiments, where he would create these models, these visualizations of, you know, trains running at the speed of light and being transparent, and flashlights and candles and observers, and, you know, to make it so that the common person could actually understand, you know, the core of what he was talking about.
I think in some small part, the comic books of their day in the 50s, too, were also tools to nudge our imaginations forward. Without them, I wonder what a rocket would look like.
Well, that's an interesting idea with the comic books. I hadn't really thought about it that way before.
Well, you know, I grew up on Saturday afternoon matinees at the movie theater in England, and one of them was Rocket Man. I remember that one very vividly, you know, along with Popeye and all the other good stuff. But Rocket Man was one out of the late 40s, early 50s, and, you know, it 50 years later, NASA comes up with a jetpack.
I think over here we have we had Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I think in a crazy kind of way, they really energized the masses to think off the planet, so to speak. And,
sure.
And that's what brings me to you. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I know that a lot of folks in my generation were inspired by the original Star Trek series.
Right.
And you'll hear lots of different, you know, people in all walks of science of that generation talk about how that inspired them, how that stimulated their thinking. And so, yeah, media, you know, and even fiction certainly stimulates the thought to try to grasp for that which is right now beyond our reach.
And right now what is beyond our reach is the total concept of what we're living within. I mean, a universe is a vast space, but it still contains something. Whether we know, whether we see it, touch it, feel it, or otherwise, we talked in the last show regarding gravity and how it's possible that gravitational pulls can literally bend time and space. But it's difficult for a person who can't jump higher than 2 feet off the ground to conceive gravity other than it holds you down.
Yes, and, you know, in established physics, we're still struggling with what the substance of gravity is. We know quite a bit about gravitational effect, and this is essentially what we were taught in school, was we weren't really taught about gravity, we were taught about gravitational effect. And we're very good at, you know, in our current state of the art, so to speak, of understanding the effect of gravity, and to the point where we can, you know, design these rockets and satellites and shoot them out into space amidst the planets of the solar systems and, you know, slingshot them around these gravity wells. We're very familiar with that. But the actual substance of gravity, what it actually is substantially, is still something which has escaped our sciences.
Now, in space, is it completely without gravity? Is it weightlessness, or is there some form of pull from somewhere or another?
Well,
is there completely nothing there, or is there something that we don't know?
The concept of this, I think, is best characterized by Einstein's fundamental vision of the universe. And what that was is that Einstein envisioned the space, for example,
mm-hmm.
which is what encapsulates the universe, really.
Right.
Space was no longer the empty void that Isaac Newton and those before him envisioned it as being. Einstein was the first one to reveal to us that space was actually substantial, that it was actually a field, and it was a continuous field, and that it was a field that was characterized by four independent variables: height, width, depth, and time. And so once we had the understanding of space as a substance, then, you know, other ideas began to come forth from that. And, of course, one of the concepts of Einstein when it comes to the spatial field, what he called the continuous spatial field, which is very little understood and very little talked about, in the mainstream media, is that Einstein felt that all pieces of matter were concentrations within that spatial field. They were densities within the wider distributed spatial field. So, for example, when we come up to a particle, we're moving through this rather featureless geometry of space,
right,
until we come up to a particle. And then Einstein said that was a place where that same field was in a form of a greater density. And he called these places matter points. And this is something that's not very understood by the layperson.
Mm-hmm.
Einstein felt that everything in the universe, matter, energy, and the entire geometry of the physical universe, was derived from this same continuous field, that there was no break between space and a physical object, that the space actually condensed into that physical object, continued into it, and then continued past it to the next one.
So like buffers, if you would.
Yeah, almost like,
like
pimples on a plane, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, hills on a plane. They're both made of sand. Everything's made of the same material. But some areas, there are greater densities and concentrations of that than another.
Mm-hmm. Now, when they talk about solar winds and this, is this throughout the universe, or is this only adjacent to our local planets?
Well, our own solar wind is certainly going to have a limited range to it.
Right.
Just like any emission of energy, it has a limited range. There are a couple forms that have extremely long ranges, like cosmic rays,
right,
and X-rays.
Uh-huh.
We have particles like neutrinos that have an extremely long range, because they have no charge, so they don't interact with anything that they're passing through or passing by.
Right.
But most of your fields do have a limited range.
So there would not be much reaction into deep space from whatever is emanating from the Earth, other than, as you say, X-rays, cosmic rays, etc.
Yes, I mean, we certainly have localizations within space-time where whatever energies are being generated or emitted, they have a limited range. Thank goodness they do.
Yeah, really. Yeah. So now we've looked at space and that it is a product. It has something, even though we haven't completely identified what this matter, this mass is. We do know it's a mass. Now, given that, when you hear the stories and the ideas of bending that matter, being able to manipulate it to either go back or forward in time, does that make it easier to understand that, given the theories that you bring to behind the cosmic veil?
Yes, it does, in that it gives us a way to get a visual handle on physical reality in its broadest sense, Colin. What it actually comprises and what it looks like, so that, for example, if we have a situation where we have the fabric of space-time that may be relatively featureless, where there is no, what Einstein called, physical content. And then we encounter a piece of matter or a particle, which is physical content. And then when we understand that what Einstein is saying is that one of the let me give a kind of a mental model, like a thought picture here.
Mm-hmm.
What I say is this: imagine a flat tabletop, and imagine that on that tabletop you have a bunch of little grains of sand distributed, across the top.
Right.
And then imagine further. Let's say that you have a very thin, transparent sheet of plastic.
Mm-hmm.
That you're not only able to lay down on that tabletop, but you're able to kind of vacuum form it to the tabletop to suck up all the air out between the plastic membrane and the table.
Right.
And the pebbles, the little, granules mm-hmm. or sand that are on that tabletop. And further, let's say that you are able to harden that plastic membrane. So here we have this flat plastic that's sealed down on that top, and
right.
everywhere we have pebbles, there's kind of pimples in that plastic sheet. If
okay.
you picked it up and you looked at that plastic sheet, you would have a very good impression, a mental concept of Einsteinian space, so that anywhere we have matter, it's a continuation of that spatial field, but there's like a pinching in it, a bubble, a pimple, if you will.
So the
but
plastic,
it's all of the same substance.
The plastic that is forming the sealed sandwich for all of the bubbles, if you will, that plastic is actually the mass of space. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. Now, what we're doing, we have to keep in mind, we're looking at it as a two-dimensional figure,
right.
Just a flat surface. But it's a sound way of looking at it, given the limitations of our human visualization. It's a good representation. And so once we can get that kind of a feel for it, we're really striking at the very heart of Einstein's relativistic theories, whereas, if people read, they study in school, Colin, and they read in a paper, about E equals MC squared, that was one of Einstein's other discoveries, that matter and energy are two forms of the same thing, that we have curvatures of space. The space actually warps and bends around all matter. And what people look at these things as isolated ideas, and what we need to understand is that most of those ideas grew out of this vision that
right.
I was just explaining, his continuous unified field.
Right. Now, when you say it bends, my visualization of that would be like when you stand on a trampoline, and the trampoline ball comes into the middle or wherever you're standing. Is that the same understanding of the bend in space?
It's an excellent way to visualize it, Colin.
Okay. And
so what Einstein talked about, he said, imagine that you had a bowl and that across the mouth of this bowl that you had a rubber sheet stretched across it. And imagine it being flat and featureless all by itself. And he said, think of that as the fabric of space-time. Then get something like a large ball bearing, very heavy, and lay it on that rubber sheet.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll notice how the presence of that ball bearing makes that rubber sheet sink down into a pocket underneath of it. And he said, this is what space does around matter. It bends. And his model of gravity was that imagine if you took a smaller ball bearing and you rolled it across the sheet, and as soon as it got into that divot that was created by the larger object, it would start rotating around and spiral down it like water going down a drain until it finally hit and made contact and came to rest against the larger ball bearing. That's Einstein's model.
Right. And let me just encapsulate how I can jump from where I'm going here. So given that and that bend, that warp in space because of matter being present, given that, is that the theory that is currently being played out regarding a form of propulsion through space other than having to use solid fuel rockets?
Well, you know, there are still there's still an awful lot of work that people are trying to do in that particular area.
Right.
And of course, we do use gravity sometimes as a form of propulsion.
Yes,
when
we do
have that slingshot effect where
yeah.
we'll, you know, launch a craft, and we used to use it in the Apollo missions
yeah.
where we get it right at the moon and then cause it to come around, and the slingshot effect from leaving that gravitational field towards
right.
the Earth would give it that extra boost in acceleration.
I remember when NASA had to make the decision of whether they were going to allow Apollo 13 to go on the dark side of the moon because it was in such bad shape. And there was a lot of sweat about that. So they really explained the gravitational pull and how it would affect the craft as it came around, and the why there was radio silence and all of that other good stuff. Now, how about this for a segue? Given that there is a certain bend in space, I'm not quite sure how time can stay constant, because it would seem that the time would warp under the same variance. That's the way I would see it. But before you answer it, Thomas, I'm going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Hugh is on the line. That's the gentleman I passed the phone number along to you a couple of weeks ago. And
yeah.
we'll chat with you, and we'll see where we stand.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Night Talk Radio on the Terror Chat Radio Network.
There's a monolith there, a very unusual structure on this little potato-shaped object that goes around Mars once in 7 hours. When people find out about that, they're going to say, who put that there? God put it there.
Nostradamus and the Antichrist, code-named Mavis, with John Hogue in the night.
According to Genesis, Eden, or Eden, is where Adam was created from dust, and Eve from one of his ribs. Others, however, have a more high-tech version of how human life began.
It is a real problem, and there's
quite a few of us, and some of us are privileged to have been briefed on some of it. It's been well covered up by all of our governments for the last 6 years or so, but slowly it's leaked out.
347-324-3287, 347-324-3287, and we remind our listeners of the archived shows, 3 years of fabulous interviews of some amazing guests. Come to the blog, nighttalkradio.com. 347-324-3287, 347-324-3287. Things that go bump in the night. To contact the show by email, terrorchat2012@gmail.com. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Colin Knight.
And we're very, very fortunate to have Thomas Fusco back with us, the author of Behind the Cosmic Veil. And we're getting into some fairly deep stuff here, Thomas, because the reason I asked before the break regarding time is, is time constant coming towards us as it is going away from us? Are we constant in both directions?
Time is a variable, and it is intrinsically linked with the spatial dimensions. This is one of the things that Einstein revealed to us, that time, like height, width, and depth, is a dimension of space. And so this is where the term space-time comes from. And you're correct in the assumption that any time that space is bending, time is also going to bend with it.
Mm-hmm.
And we get some very odd effects, like we know that a clock runs at a different rate at the equator than it does at the North Pole.
Right.
Because the spatial variables do change with velocity. And so it gets a little bit intricate, but yes, time is an integral part of that spatial field.
So in theory, if the Earth began to slow, you know, the way they talk regarding the Big Bang Theory is that currently we are still expanding, and in such we are in an outward motion, but there will become a time, they believe, that that outward motion will cease and it will begin to collapse back in on itself, taking another trillion years or whatever. Given that, would time be traveling constant, or it would only be constant to its actual moment and motion?
The only place where time is a constant and it is not a variable is at the speed of light.
Okay.
In fact, at the speed of light, all four of the spatial variables become unvarying. They become constant. If we take a look at the equation, and I promise not to do any equations, but everybody's heard of E equals MC squared. Well, the C is the constant. It represents the speed of light. And the reason why the speed of light is a constant is because the four variables, height, width, depth, and time, become a constant and an unvarying value at that velocity.
Hmm. So, it would be possible, in theory, for to devise a method to bend time. It must be possible to be able to control. If something is a mass, then it needs something that is more powerful to control the mass. So,
well, here's where my work starts to come in on this.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the key concepts that went into this theory, into my work, was the mysteries that are surrounding gravity.
Right.
And gravity is very unique in the universe. Not only is it this force that coagulates things and makes different particles come together and assemble themselves into recognizable geometric forms like galaxies and stars and
right.
solar systems and this kind of thing. But every time we try to qualify gravity as a force, we are constantly thwarted. Technically, what a force is actually conveyed by a particle that propagates as a wave. So in electromagnetism, for example, we have an electron, which is a particle, and it propagates as an electromagnetic field, and that's what conveys that force of electromagnetism. For gravity to be a force, we have to come up with a particle of gravity, which would be a gravitational boson, or more commonly called a graviton.
Okay.
But we've been looking for gravitons for decades and have never found one.
Now, is that what the huge European collider is all about? Is that what they believe is those building blocks that they claim that they're looking for?
Well, they really, to my knowledge, really did not expect to find a graviton.
Right.
What they're looking for other kinds of particles and interactions, this Higgs boson being one of them. They found kind of a particle that sort of kind of maybe might be something that fits a description of the Higgs. But no, they're not looking for gravitons in that particular facility. We have no clue as to how to find a graviton. We've not even qualified it.
We have no measurement and no model at all.
You're exactly right. Now, one of the main purposes of the Large Hadron Collider is to complete what they call the standard model of the universe. This is what physicists use to describe the particles and their interactions in the universe.
Okay.
And by standard model, I mean capital S, capital M. There
right.
was this big hole in the standard model that needed to be filled by something like a Higgs boson. But there is no place or no expression in the standard model for gravity. And
It just is another problem. Gravity just is.
Yeah, we don't know what it is. When we have these two different models of the universe, broad models, we have relativity and we have quantum physics.
Mm-hmm.
And they describe two very different worlds and two very different sets of rules. And when we try to reconcile the two of them into one system, the stumbling block that we've never been able to overcome is gravity. When Einstein tried to come up with a mathematical proof for his unified field theory, he stumbled on gravity. He was not able to express gravity mathematically through four dimensions. And now we've got increasing mysteries where we've discovered in recent decades that close to 90% of the bending of space and associated gravitational fields that we observe in the universe has no visible mass adjacent to it. This is why physics has made up this, really, it's an imaginary substance called dark matter,
right,
which we don't have a stitch of physical evidence for. We just have a lot of observations which an invisible form of matter would be very convenient to explain. So everywhere we turn, everywhere we look at gravity, we come up short. We come up with the problem that we can't make it fit into any of our conventional models that explain all other kinds of realities or aspects of reality. So for me, this is where gravity became a fundamental key, that the reason why we're having these problems isn't because we're not digging deeper enough, as conventional physics says, but that we're looking at gravity all wrong, that we're looking at it with an incorrect paradigm. And
we are trying to fit gravity into a battery, a electrical supply, a brain system. You know, we don't know the carrier of gravity. We have no
right.
idea.
Right. Well, modern physics still works under the materialistic paradigm
right.
that really was established by Michael Faraday and it slipped by my James Clerk Maxwell in the 1800s.
And that was the Faraday cage, wasn't it?
Well, that comes later. But they worked under the assumption that because gravity appeared to behave like electromagnetism,
right. Then
it must be a force, an attracting force, very similar to electromagnetism. And with that paradigm, we have never been able to carry it past a certain point. We can't close the deal, so to speak. We can't close the circle on it.
And one day we will. We will. We'll find it.
I think that what we need to do is come up with a different paradigm for gravity, a different way of looking at it.
Well, I think, I think we're intelligent enough to do that. I really do. I think the answer is out there. And I tend to agree with you. One of our favorite catchphrases is thinking outside of the box. And I agree. I think a lot of the problems of our world, we're looking at it from a man-made formula that was forced into fitting with what was happening in life. It's much like believing 100% in Freud.
Yes, and you're right. We certainly have a tendency to, you're talking about what I call conventional thinking.
Right.
That we look for patterns that we know and recognize and we've learned and try to superimpose those patterns on new findings and new observations.
Yeah, exactly.
And, excuse me, oftentimes it works quite a bit. But with gravity, this is something which has,
it has no equal.
Yeah. And so for me, what I wanted to do was to step back and take another look at Einstein's model of the continuous spatial field.
Right.
And, what came to me when I looked at that and really, really thought about it, because, again, Einstein was never able to prove mathematically his unified field theory, but much of the ideas that came out of his relativistic theories were based on that concept of the universe. If we think about this very carefully, what Einstein's saying is that anywhere where there is matter, we have a pimpling or a pinching of the spatial field. Now, if that's the case, then maybe it's not that the physical content is the thing that's actually bending and pinching space. When I look at Einstein's basic model, what grows naturally out of it for me, is the idea that it is the bending of space which produces matter.
Hmm.
And that opposite of what the conventional view is. But when you set aside all of those conventions and begin to look at it that way, then it almost becomes frightening in its ramifications.
And in its such simplicity, when you think about it, we are looking for such a convoluted, high performance, we're looking so far into the stars. I think we're chopping off our nose. I think we're going to find that it is such a simple theory that is supportable that we'll feel silly that we didn't figure it out years ago.
Well, certainly one of the things, one of the greatest minds of our time, Nikola Tesla.
My hero.
Oh, my. Oh, my. I mean, something, that man's brain worked differently. There's no question about that. But one of the quotes of him is that he said, physicists concentrate too much on particles and mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
He says they need to think more about frequency and vibration.
Yeah.
Another thing Tesla said is that if we took more time to study the non-physical aspects of reality, he said we will make more progress in 10 years scientifically than we will have in the entire history of humanity.
Yeah. I remember reading, actually, and watching, I think it was a video, but on Tesla regarding a vibration machine that he had invented. And the machine, had it allowed to complete its vibration cycle, would have brought down the whole city block in which that laboratory was located. And that was without a shot fired, he could take out a city, basically.
Well,
and the military ramifications were horrendous.
Here's where my model would kind of synchronize with that. If we take this exact opposite approach, if we think that instead of matter bending space, if we think of matter emerging from the bends of space, that the bending of space that's associated with gravitational fields is not an effect of matter, but a cause of matter. And then if furthermore we understand that the space being a field has a frequency resonance, it has each location in space, according to my model, and I think Einstein would have agreed with this, because of the four variables that define it, every single coordinate in space has a unique frequency resonance than any other coordinate in space. Now, if you were going to build a vibration machine, like what we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
that would actually vibrate the frequency resonance of the spatial field. And if further we say that my assumption is correct, that matter emerges from the spatial field, if we disturb that field, we disintegrate the matter that it's containing.
Hmm. So how would you move from 2012 to 2035 or backwards? If that is, as you state, if that is the cause and causality, how would that be possible? And yet it seems that we are on the verge of understanding that.
Well, here's what the challenge is in the current model of physics that we have in trying to express this idea that I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the, and remember in the last show, we started talking about information.
Yes.
This is another important ingredient, an element. If we're talking about the universe as being an expression of materialized information within the curvatures of space, what we see in most areas of the universe is a very static picture, that most all of our physical structures, whether we observe them locally in front of us or on grand scales, galactic scales, we find that those structures are very, very stable and that their formation is already established for the most part. They alter and change, but their creation is pretty much established. But here, now we go into the element or the body of paranormal evidence, because
mm-hmm.
paranormal phenomena, Colin, gives us the opportunity to see real-time materialization and dematerialization of information in a very immediate and quick way. We're no longer looking at stable structures. We're looking at unstable structures that materialize and dematerialize out of space-time. So when we take this model that I have and apply it to what happens in sites of hauntings, this is where we can start making scientific breakthroughs, because my model makes certain predictions about what we'll find at testing with certain experiments at the sites of paranormal hauntings.
Right.
And some of those predictions have already been experimentally verified.
Now, there's something that I can get my teeth into. I know exactly what you are speaking of. My only query on that theory is this residual data that is kind of overlapping from another time continuum, or is this happening in the in its time that it is it's modeled? You know, people see Roman soldiers marching through walls, and they see sometimes see Wild West cowboy preachers and that kind of thing. Is it time is only relative to each piece of energy, correct?
Well, this is where it gets a little tricky, and this is where it gets very confusing sometimes. And what we need to, one of the things, Colin, that we have traditionally been confused about with conventional thinking when looking at paranormal events is to try to interpret them and try to assign to them material or physical characteristics. And not all of them, to me, in my model, not every aspect of paranormal effect is physical.
Right.
So when we start talking about, let's say, other dimensions, well, dimensions are physical.
Mm-hmm.
So by the second we mention the word dimension, we have confined our thinking to what's within space-time.
Right.
And that's why people start talking about this and get confused, and they wind up finding their minds going into circles because they can't break out of that paradigm. We
do tend to Star Trek everything, don't we, to understand it?
Well, yeah, that's a natural tendency because it's part of our our culture.
Yeah, Thomas, we've had Hugh, the gentleman that we had a brief discussion with on the first show. He's been holding like a gentleman online.
Oh boy! Alrighty.
So we'll bring him up. And good evening, Hugh. Glad you could make it to the show. I'm sorry for holding you so long, but when Thomas gets me going, my mind has a million questions.
Well, I'm delighted to listen to the both of you, and I hope I'm not interrupting the flow, but it's just fantastic information. I just wanted to touch on one thing, and I'll explain a product that I invented since we're talking about information, just to see what Thomas's insight might be on it. I created this on July 11th, 2011. I call it a Y-Pod, and I'm bringing it from the spiritual into the physical realm. I offer the basic concept free to all mankind to help them with their spirituality and creativity.
And what does it do, Hugh?
That's what I'm going to explain now. This can be utilized on and off the grid. Off the grid, it can be as simple as an index card file of contacts and opportunities that you empower and give value to by how you interact and network with it. YPOD stands for Your Personal Opportunity Database. On the internet, it could be a website, a blog, or a social media application. Those can be portals to sophisticated computer coded pre-qualified global business opportunities. It now gives people the opportunity to take control over a business until they're ready to ripple it out into the world transparently with love.
Well, I just put you on hold because you threw a lot of information in there. So, Thomas, do you think that mankind is strapped to the earth by the internet and situations such as that? Are we bound by some kind of a code not to go into space and not to try and breach these energy barriers through moving back or forward in time?
Well, boy, that was. You just tossed in another two-hour conversation with the plan for words.
Sorry about that.
But the way I look at it, Colin, is this. Again, my way of looking at the universe is that it is an expression of materialized and materializing information. And when we look at the universe at that with that paradigm, we begin to look at ourselves differently. And what I mean is this. If you take a look around yourself, I know I'm looking around the office where I'm sitting here right now. Virtually every single thing I see is a materialization of the information that originated in a human brain.
Okay.
The telephone that I'm talking on is
right.
a materialization of information from a lot of different human brains that actually has been materialized into a physical object that I'm holding and using in a mm-hmm. way that would never occur in nature. And
true.
Yet, our brains use the same process that the universe, in my opinion, that the universe was created from.
Okay.
It would be unreasonable to think that universal creation works on a different set of laws and principles than human creation does. And so I think that anything that we can conceive and that we can materialize is not in a way forbidden, in other words, from a human limitation.
Mm-hmm.
What we can imagine is what we cannot imagine is our limitations. Anything that we can conceive is within our ability to achieve.
Right, right. And you see, I'm hooked on this space-time continuum kind of thought process only because it would seem to me that if in the future we learn to go back in time, why is it that so many atrocities were allowed to be committed? I can't see how somebody could go back in time and simply watch without doing something sooner or later. So I tend not to believe in the ability to move in time. Yet we are being visited on a daily, monthly, weekly, yearly basis. And it is clear that they are much more advanced than we are, whether they are our own people from the future or aliens from another world.
Well, you know, when you're talking about time travel, you're speaking about a couple of very difficult paradoxes that do not succumb to conventional and linear thinking very easily.
Okay.
Let's say theoretically, someone in the present, like yourself or myself,
mm-hmm.
were able to somehow travel 100 years in the past.
Right.
Well, you have created a continuum between the past and the present. By moving from the present to the past, you have
okay.
actually made the past and the present cohabitate in the same realm, in the same local reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so consequently, you cannot change the past without changing the present.
Gotcha.
And that obviously is so complex it would have quite,
yeah.
Unexpected consequences. So when you get into those kind of paradoxes,
right.
It becomes very difficult to try to break them down and think about them in the ways that we normally think about everyday life.
Now, as Hugh was mentioning, you know, he came up with a concept for a product, and he visualized it, he created it, and he rolled it out, and, you know, he's quite confident that it's going to do big things for the world, because he threw the disclaimer on it that, you know, this wasn't going to be another iPod, and he's not going to be selling them all over the place. Now, given that, what would happen if the collective consciousness of everybody on Earth all thought the same thing at the same process? Would it manifest itself? Would it have to? Would it have to become reality?
Well, I think this is where another one of my paradigms, which kind of goes contrary to how we conventionally look at things, is that the conceptualization within the human brain already makes it a physical reality.
Gotcha.
You know,
yeah.
What I tell people is this, you know, and this is a scientific principle. When we study systems, we understand that a system is defined by a set of laws and principles and definitions. And then we further understand that any subsystem, any subset of that greater system will always conform to the laws and the principles that govern the greater system in which it is a subset. So if we expand that and look at the universe as a giant system governed by and defined by a very specific set of laws and principles, and then we further understand that the human brain is a subset of that greater universal system, then everything that goes on in the human brain is consistent with the laws and the principles that establish and govern the greater system, which it is a part.
So would you call that a universal concept? Would you call it a universal energy code of some kind? Are we powering our own energy grid? You know, they talk about your aura and all of this. Are we, as a human species, are we powering some form of connection between human beings? Because we seem to have lost something of communication. I don't know exactly what it is, Thomas, but it never used to be as difficult to be able to communicate with societies as it seems to be around the world today. And let me just extrapolate a little further on that. I was told recently from a professor out of England, which I'm hoping to have on in a couple of months when he's finished the project that he's working on. But he told me that that Earth vibrates at a certain frequency. And if that vibration is interrupted or changed, then those that live upon the Earth will be altered exponentially. And that could account for the anger and the hate and the violence that we're seeing currently. Now, would that fit within your model as you see it behind the cosmic veil?
Now, in a very, very broad sense, maybe so. what I've tried to do, Colin, is to stay away from philosophy,
right,
and metaphysics. One of the things that distinguishes my work is that it does have a scientific foundation in its concepts and its principles, and that there are portions of it that are experimentally testable. Now, in this idea where we say, you know, the Earth has quote-unquote a frequency, well, I don't think there's any materialization that is a function of a single frequency, that we have a multitude of frequencies. In fact, the entire universe is a highly complex collection of wave functions.
Right.
So when we start saying the Earth has a frequency, already we're talking about something that really is more philosophical. Because if we were starting to talk about the frequency of the Earth itself, we would have to be speaking plural. And so I try to stay away from the philosophical way of doing it. That's
okay.
We've already had hundreds of years of that.
Yeah, I can relate to that. And unfortunately, I think that's how human beings are kind of put into the mix and the tools given to try and understand the concepts that we're discussing tonight. They are deep and they are thick and heavy, but only because, as you said right at the beginning, you have to cast off the what we already know theory and have a look at what's really happening.
But what we also have, and you're right, Colin, but what also we have to do is to lay a foundation.
Yeah.
Without a common foundation that has a good scientific backing to it, a kind of a stake that you can place in the ground,
right,
we're on quicksand. This is why all these philosophers come up with all these different ideas, and you hear all these different kinds of what I call the metaphysical theory du jour.
Right.
You know, that every day somebody's coming up with a different metaphysical system. slapping a new coat of paint on it, putting a new name on it, sticking it out there, and it's just a merry-go-round.
I agree.
Because there's no foundation. Anything that you think or imagine is fine if it makes some sort of logic or sense.
Let me just hold you there just for a brief second. For those stations down the line, we are going down to the bottom of the hour. If you want to stay with us, we'd love to have you. If not, adios. Okay, sorry, Thomas. So what you come up with to answer that issue?
Well, what I'm saying is this, and to go back to my original basic concept,
right,
is that what we're looking at is the bending of space that creates an environment in which information materializes. That the bending of space, these pockets, are actually what creates, in a sense, matter. It is a very literal interpretation of Einstein's continuous spatial field. Now, to test this, the easiest way that we could possibly test this is, number one, find a collection of observations where it appears that information is unstable, that it materializes and dematerializes in real time in a short time segment. We're not talking about billions of years that the sun existed.
Right.
We're talking about something that's not only on a human scale time-wise, you know, moments or hours or minutes,
mm-hmm,
but is also on a human scale size-wise. So, like, people talk about trying to study UFOs. Well, they're flying around, you know, 1,000 feet in the air, and who knows how big they are and
right,
whatever. But in a site of a paranormal haunting, it's right in front of us, and it's on a human scale. So what I say is this. Let me take this model and bring it into a haunted house and say, if we saw this, if we had the bending of space inside of a haunted house with information that would materialize in that bending of space, and then we were able to test that environment where that was happening, what kind of effects would we observe?
Mm-hmm.
And this is where this theory actually gets some scientific verification, and not only validates it, but also validates paranormal phenomena. It sheds light on parapsychology.
Mm-hmm.
It sheds light on things like why we can't find gravitons and why there was an early expansion of the universe. I mean, this is a very, I don't want to say global because that's just the Earth. It's a very universal model. So if what I like to do is to talk about how this model would produce all of what I call the primary and secondary paranormal effects, every one that are observed at the sites that we call haunted.
Right. So once you have been able to literally measure that moment with something that has can give you a solid understanding of where it came from. When we get to that point, then the chances are that we're going to be able to answer the other questions of the universe.
Yes, to a large extent, because what we've done is that we've cracked a secret about the way that the universe is put together that we didn't know before. Modern physics and our standard model and our conventional theories do not accommodate or describe paranormal phenomena. Yet paranormal phenomena does occur. Furthermore, paranormal phenomena occurs within the physical universe, which means that paranormal phenomena is a subsystem of the greater system of the universe, which further means that paranormal phenomena must act and behave in a way that is consistent with the laws and principles that the whole universe is put together with.
Right.
Furthermore, paranormal phenomena is a physically observable effect. Now, if it's a physically observable effect, not only should it be measurable, which we know it is, and observable, but if this model that I'm talking about is correct, we would get very specific observations and measurements, some which were unexpected, some which were which you would not have been able to predict just based on the observations themselves, but are predicted by this greater model, this greater theory.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand exactly where it comes together. I guess not being a skeptic, but being cautious regarding the matching or the merging, if you will, of Einstein's theory. But it fits, and there is a, you know, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. There's only one piece going to fit there, and that one fit. And I think as you plod along through each piece of life and human mankind's abilities, I think you're going to find that it continues to fit, Thomas.
Well, what I've done with Einstein's work is I have what I call extended it superphysically.
Right.
Basically, what I'm doing conceptually is what the mathematician and theoretical physicist Theodore Kaluza did with Einstein's work. Einstein was never able to mathematically demonstrate his unified field theory, that in the beginning, everything was combined into a single field, which differentiated and trickled out, so to speak, into all the fields and dimensions that we know of now.
Right.
And he was never able to do that within the confines of the physical.
Uh-huh.
And even till this day, we've not been able to reconcile this mathematically. There was one man who was able to do so, a contemporary of Einstein. He was working alongside of Einstein, trying to help out and work on some of his math. And Kaluza came up with an idea one day. He said, what if we add a fifth coordinate beyond height, width, depth, and time? It's not included in there. This coordinate isn't even physical. It doesn't reside in the physical universe. It resides somewhere outside of the physical universe. We really don't know where. It's just a mathematical construct, so to speak.
Okay.
And let's add this fifth coordinate into the equations. So Kaluza did that, and he worked Einstein's unified field equations with a fifth coordinate. And, of course, just before the sum of the equation at the end, which has to be completely physical, he subtracted the non-physical coordinate out of it, so that all he would have left was the four dimensions of space-time.
Hmm.
And lo and behold, Kaluza was the only human being that ever balanced Einstein's unified field equations.
Now, why was it, how can I ask, was it a standard mathematical practice that he applied, or would this have been found by somebody else? Was it a stumble, or was this a very pinpoint approach to that particular section of Einstein's theory?
I think that for Kaluza, from what I understand, it was a mathematician's way of trying something new.
Isn't that interesting how a mathematician would solve such a universal problem?
Mm-hmm. Now, the problem why it's not generally accepted in mainstream physics as a valid model, other than an interesting mathematical curiosity with some, you know, real ramifications to it,
right,
is that the current model of physics is based on a paradigm that all of reality is physical, that everything that is reality is confined within the dimensions of space and time, that the universe, and you may have, some of your listeners may have heard this term, is self-determining or self-explaining, that every physical effect in the universe has a physical cause contained within the same universe. And so this is the modern physics paradigm. And this is why they come up with things when they see gravitational effect with no physical cause. They have to make up imaginary physical causes like dark matter.
Right.
When they see the expansion of the universe beyond what the physical content of the universe would explain, they have to make up hypothetical materials called dark energy. Well, Kaluza's model of a five-dimensional reality isn't generally accepted, even though it works mathematically, because part of his equation lies outside of the physical confines of space and time. So,
and thus the resistance of everybody that has been educated in one direction.
Yeah, so, you know, if it cannot be measured, if it cannot be quantified, if it cannot be qualified in a physical sense, then it doesn't exist.
Right.
This is the modern paradigm of physics. You know, and if we observe something that we don't have a physical cause for, we make up, we imagine, we predict a physical cause and say that this is what, you know, this is what causes the effect. This is why the standard model has no expression for gravity, because we have no theoretical model that predicts a material cause for gravity. And
so what you're telling me is I'm wasting my money trying to go back in time and take care of a few issues I should have taken care of 20, 30 years ago.
Well, here's the thing. When we approach the outermost limits of space-time,
right,
which is the speed of light,
okay,
space and time begin to collapse in on themselves. And when we reach the speed of light, we are actually in a constant where space and time no longer varies within its four dimensions. It is a constant. Now, when we're able to extend that above the speed of light, dimensions disappear as we understand them. They turn into what we call a singularity. Mathematically, that would be expressed as an infinite volume, an infinite value. And so when we get to that point, there are no longer any differences between the dimensions or the differences between 500 years ago and today. Remember, time is a dimensional expression of differences between events.
Right.
So when we measure an event, you know, 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue.
Right.
You know, that's an event. And we can measure the difference between that event and, as we're speaking right at this moment, with the dimension of time.
Mm-hmm.
Just like I can measure the difference between my mouth, my lips, and the telephone,
right,
with the dimensions of space. But when those dimensions collapse into a singularity, there is no difference between the event of 1492 and the event of today.
Okay. You see, what I have the difficulty with is, for some reason, I have this model, this concept in my head that if we could go back and basically take out, let's say, Hitler. That there would have been no Nazi movement, no this, no that, no this, no that. But at the same time, by us doing that, the chances are that there would be no us either. You see
Colin, once again, you've gotten into philosophy.
Yeah.
You know, for me, the question would be, first, how would we accomplish time travel?
Right.
That's the scientific end of it.
Right.
The idea of going back and killing Hitler is a philosophical aspect of it.
Right. Using him, it could have been Attila the Hun or Julius Caesar or, you know, or Pontius Pilate. I mean, I just chose one. But yeah, I see exactly what you're saying in reference to your formula, how it fits and how it works. And I understand that, unfortunately, most people are taught certain things of physics and space-time universal issues that are incorrect. And until you can accept the movement of some of those things, including religious, it is difficult to understand the full concept.
Well, certainly. And again, one of the conventional thinkings or ways of thinking that confuses us is when we mix philosophy and science to where the lines between them blur.
Mm-hmm.
So like when the idea, go back in time and kill Attila the Hun.
Right.
Now, we've just blurred philosophy and science to a point to where we cannot clearly see one as distinctly different from the other. It's just like in the studying of paranormal phenomena, most theories revolve around an intelligent spirit, a disembodied intelligence, a demonic, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying that those things do not exist. What I'm saying is that when you bring them in to your reckoning of what you are physically observing, you blur your thinking to the point where you simply cannot see what's in front of your eyes. And I'll give you an example. This is a real good one. Everybody gets we all know from watching these TV shows, you know, paranormal investigations, that they run around with these electromagnetic field detectors.
Right.
And they see all these emerging electromagnetic fields. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get this phenomenon that their electrical equipment begins to malfunction.
Right.
You know, batteries look like they're drained, the cameras don't work, this and that and everything.
Gotcha, yep.
Now, they got a spirit in their reckoning. They got the disembodied intelligence as a fundamental part of their model of what's going on. So that gives them a idea, a theory, that the spirits are drawing energy from the batteries in order to physically manifest. Because they got a spirit stuck in the middle of their reasoning. Now, this is where I can show you right away how screwed up this is, how faulty this is. Let's take a look at another branch of the paranormal, which is UFOs.
Okay.
Isn't it funny, in the close proximity of a sighting of a UFO, occasionally the exact same phenomenon is reported. Suddenly, cars go dead, car batteries seem to be completely drained, radios don't work, flashlights don't work. And, of course, as soon as the UFO leaves, everything goes back to normal.
Right.
Now, I can't find a single individual, either who has experienced it and observed it, or someone who theorizes on it, that thinks that the UFO is draining the batteries out of your flashlight in order to physically manifest. Why not? Because they don't have a ghost stuck in between their thinking.
Yeah.
So here's what we have. Now, let's remove the ghost for a minute. I'm not saying he's not there. Let's just remove him for a minute. Here we have people running around with electromagnetic meters, and they're seeing these electromagnetic fields emerge. And then suddenly they have a malfunctioning in their electrical equipment. Well, this is a well-known physical phenomenon, that we actually have weapons that we produce.
Right, exactly.
Through EMF pulses, we can disable electrical equipment. This is a normal, well-established phenomenon.
Yeah, it's not a secret, that's for sure.
Yeah, because they have a ghost in their thinking, They literally cannot see what is right in front of their faces.
So they have, with this electromagnetic field that does seem to appear, they manifest what they see?
I don't know where you're going with that, Colin.
When people claim to have seen a ghost, is that a manifestation of the field around that person, or is that genuinely a print or a signal or reality from another time?
I think it's definitely a real phenomenon. It's definitely something that happens independent of someone who's imagining it to happen. It almost sounds like you're saying the observer makes it happen.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm just wondering if we, without emptying our mind, if you believe there's a ghost in a building, and there's a creak of a door and a drip of a tap and a this
yeah,
and a that.
I understand what you're saying.
You're going to manifest a ghost, I'm quite sure.
Well, this is what I would say about that. How many people have purchased a house that they fell in love with and was lovely, and then they found out it was haunted? Did that person expect to see a ghost? How about the person who comes into a haunted house, as a skeptic, and says there's no such thing as ghosts and I'm not going to see a thing? And then they get the bejeepers scared out of them.
Yeah.
How did they create a ghost? It's too simple of an answer, Colin.
Yeah.
It's another one of these philosophizing ideas that I hear from time to time that is just a nice way of looking at it. It's a convenient way of explaining it, but it doesn't account for the entire body of evidence.
Exactly.
It takes a little window and then explains what's in that window, and then tries to say that the entire building is like what you see in that window.
Right. So I tell you what, let's take a quick break here, and we're going to go down to about 5 before the bottom of the hour, and I just have some hoorays to do at the end. If you'll hang with me, Thomas, I'll be right back.
Okay.
And we'll be right back with Thomas Fusco.
Comments and statements made by tonight's host or guests remain the opinion of the speaker and not necessarily the opinion of the TerraChat Network or any TerraChat affiliates or sponsors. This is Night Talk Radio on the TerraChat Radio Network with host Colin Matt. Comments and statements made by tonight's host or guests remain the opinion of the speaker and not necessarily the opinion of the TerraChat Network. Kavia Entor. This is Night Talk Radio on the TerraChat Radio Network with host Colin Knight.
And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, to an extended version of Night Talk. We normally schedule 60 minutes, but tonight I have with me Thomas Fusco, author of Behind the Cosmic Veil, and we've been getting into some heated information regarding Mr. Fusco's theory and understanding of the cosmic world. And I've been trying to push him into the more faith-based world, if you will, and he has resisted like a gentleman. and I truly appreciated it because I understand his understanding. Thomas, now, as we head down to the bottom of the hour, I just want to say that I have read your book. I did manage to get through it over the last few days, and it was absolutely amazing, your detective work, if you will.
Well, I put a lot of years in it, and I wanted to cover all my bases and to come up with a model that whatever we, like a mirror, whatever we
right.
hold this mirror to, it reflects something meaningful back.
Mm-hmm.
Wherever, whatever field that we can address and whatever anomalies and mysteries that we can look at, I wanted this model to be able to say something consistent and coherent and meaningful
right.
about it.
And you most certainly did do that, sir. So for our listeners out there, those that are with us live and those that will be picking us up on archive at a later time, Behind the Cosmic Veil, author Thomas Fusco. And how can people get a hold of that book, Thomas?
Well, everything about the book, finding out about the book, there's even a sample chapter there, where I'm going to be appearing next, some related articles, where to buy the book. All of that can be found at www.cosmicveil, spelled V-E-I-L, cosmicveil.com.
Okay, and that's pretty good. So make sure you go out and check the site out. Have a look around. You know, keep an open mind and understand what Thomas has come to conclude. Now, Thomas, before you leave, sir, has this understanding of the universe, as you know it, has this given you peace in your life? Is it a compilation and a victory, or is there more to do?
You know, it's that's hard to answer. I didn't seek it, you know, so much to find peace,
right.
but to find answers so that, you know, the universe made sense.
Right.
You know, in itself, has it brought me any kind of a peace? I don't think so.
Okay.
It's just something that I've discovered, and it's kind of like my mission to be the herald for it.
Mm-hmm. I get that. I get that. Thomas, it's been an absolute pleasure. I appreciate you being back, sir. And we're going to have to do it again real soon because one edition opens up the doors for another edition. And I have a million more questions. And I'm sure the audience will be sending me some emails. So, Thomas, let's look for another date down the road, and I'd love to have you back soon.
That sounds great, Colin. I'd love to be back on the show with you.
Fabulous. Thomas Fusco, ladies and gentlemen, the fantastic book. Make sure you have a scoop over at his website. The book, Behind the Cosmic Veil, Google it, and it'll pop up with all kinds of links to get to Thomas's website. And then you'll be able to check it out yourself. And like I say, it's definitely worth the read. And go in with an open mind. Because if you have a closed mind, it becomes a terrible, terrible thing. And you won't get anywhere with any of the information that's offered. But if you keep your mind open, then you can accomplish all kinds of things. Now, this is the Night Talk radio tonight. Tomorrow night, of course, VOCR radio. We're going to get into some deep and dirty politics. We're going to review the Sharia law again and answer some hate mail. So hopefully you'll join us. And we're also going to run two VOCRs next week. One probably Tuesday evening, and the next one on the weekend. So we look forward to sharing that with you. In the meantime, in between time, that's it, that's all. Another edition of Night Talk Radio. Bye now.
Hey there, got a minute? We all have busy lives.
sometimes we forget the small things in life that make many people happy. We work hard and we earn a great deal of money, or we hope to, and we spend a great deal of money. And yet there are those in our world who have no money to spend. There are those in this world that are fighting for survival as we speak. Give a moment to think of those people. Do what you can as a good human being. Do what you can to help their world be a little brighter. Good night, and we'll catch you back here on the next edition. This has been a TerraChat Network production. www.terrachatnet.com.